So we're actually going to be taking our reading from Deuteronomy and chapter 18. And I'm going to get Dawn to come up and read the, our verses today. We're going to be reading from verse 9 through to verse 22.
When you come into the land that the Lord your God has given you, you must not learn to imitate the abhorrent practices of those nations. No one shall be found among you who makes a son or a daughter pass through the fire, or who practices divination, or is a soothsayer, or an augur, or a sorcerer, or one who casts spells, or consults ghosts or spirits, or who seeks oracles from the dead. For whoever does these things is abhorrent to the Lord. It is because of such abhorrent practices that the Lord your God is driving them out before you. You must remain completely loyal to the Lord your God. Although these nations that you are about to dispossess do give heed to the soothsayers and diviners, as for you, the Lord your God does not permit you to do so. The Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me among your people, and you shall take heed to such a prophet. This is what you requested of the Lord at Horeb at the day of assembly, when you said, "If I hear the voice of the Lord my God any more, or ever again see that great fire, I will die." Then the Lord replied to me, "They are right in what they have said. I will rise up for them a prophet like you among their own people. I will put my words in the mouth of that prophet, who shall speak to them in everything that I command. Anyone who does not heed the words of that prophet shall speak in my name. I myself will hold accountable. But any prophet who speaks in the name of other gods, or presumes to speak in my name a word that I have not commanded the prophet to speak, then that prophet shall die." You may say to yourself, "How can we recognize a word that the Lord has not spoken?" If a prophet speaks the name of the Lord, but the things do not take place or prove true, it is a word that the Lord has not spoken. The prophet has spoken presumptuously. Do not be frightened by it.
I'm going to bring you a second reading from Hebrews chapter 1, verse 1. "Long ago, and many times, and in many ways, God spoke to our fathers by the prophets. But in these last days, he has spoken to us by his Son, whom he appointed heir of all things, through whom he also created the world. He is the radiance of the glory of God and the exact imprint of his nature, and he upholds the universe by the word of his power." Amen. We've been working through the book of Deuteronomy. What we can see, when putting the book in context, Israel, the nation, has been miraculously rescued from Egypt. And now they've been taken out and they stand on the border of the land that had been promised to their forefather Abraham. At last they've seen the promises of God to Abraham for their nation. At last they were seeing it about to be fulfilled. Now the law of God had already been given from Sinai in the wilderness on the way, on a great mountain there. And the details of the law recorded partially in Exodus, rest of it in Leviticus. And here we come to Deuteronomy. The title of the book means literally second law. And what it actually is, it's actually a legal agreement. It's a contract, a document, a covenant between God and the nation of Israel. And what we've seen as we've looked through Deuteronomy is that this contract is actually a watered-down version of the law. It's not the full law in all its details. It's watered down. And basically what's happening in Deuteronomy is the minimum standards expected by God are laid out here in order for Israel to retain possession of the land. The minimum moral standards for God's human ambassadors, for the people representing God here on earth, these are the minimum standards that God was setting for the promised land. And in return, the other part of this contract, the other part of this agreement, is that God, if they keep their side of the bargain, that God will keep his, and he will provide blessing and prosperity and security, and he will be their God. We've already highlighted this is intended to be an exclusive agreement just for the people of Israel. So we have to have a look at that in context. But what we've seen, and what we've seen so far, is that Jesus referred back to the book of Deuteronomy more than any other book in the New Testament, because it's full of rich ideas and full of foreshadowing pointing towards Jesus Christ and his coming. Now, Moses is giving this book, he's doing it as a preacher and as a teacher and as a prophet to Israel. And basically what he does is he lays out one of the founding principles of this agreement in Deuteronomy 6 verse 5. It's the second half of the Shema. You'll hear Jews recounting it. And Jesus confirms that this is the founding principle of God's law in Mark 12, and Luke 10. And it's this: love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your strength. And what Moses goes on to do in the next verses of chapter 6, he says to the Jews, you cannot just pay lip service to this law. You can't just follow the duties and just go through the motions. What's going to happen when you move into this promised land? It has to be a way of life for you. So in verses 6 to 9 of Deuteronomy 6, this is what Moses says: these commands that I give you today are to be upon your hearts. Impress them on your children. Talk about them when you sit at home, and when you walk on the road, and when you lie down, and when you get up. Tie them as symbols on your hands. Bind them on your foreheads. Write them on the door frames of your houses and on your gates. It should be just infusing everything. Now, in our modern day society, and I'm sure Seven and I have looked at this as they've looked at parenthood and had the little parenthood classes, and anybody that's been working in schools will know this, anybody that's been trained in teaching, that the current things that are in vogue is positive reinforcement. So the idea is that rather than doing anything negative, which gets people down, I think the ratio was, when I was a teacher, was 10 to 1. You've got to give 10 lots of positive reinforcement for every one negative that you do. So, and that was the rule that they tried to help us stay by. So anyway, this is an idea in modern thought, in modern psychology, in modern teaching. So encourage and reinforce good behaviours and good practices. Always positive. So for God, he actually invented it. You know, long before our modern psychologists had. And what he's done throughout most of Deuteronomy so far is he said what the Israelites should do. Do this, do that. Remember this, remember that. Enjoy the feast, enjoy the blessings. All real positive stuff. But as I say, the modern psychologists didn't invent positive reinforcement, because Jesus practiced and demonstrated it. So Jesus made it clear that all of the law could be summed up in just two verses: love the Lord your God and love your neighbour as yourself. And so what we find is that when Peter failed, if you remember, when he denied knowing Jesus and left Jesus to go through to the trial and the cross, when they eventually meet up after Jesus' resurrection, Jesus didn't reprimand him. He didn't preach. He didn't hammer home the negative repercussions. He goes back to these basics. John 21, he says, do you love me? Do you truly love me? Then go and do what I've called you to do. Feed my sheep. Take care of my people. But Jesus wasn't afraid of using the negative. As you go through his teaching time and time again, he gives harsh warnings of the consequences of people's actions. You know, if you don't follow me, you're destined for the fire. You're going to be cut off from my presence. You're going to face judgment, and it's not going to go well for you. Time and time again, he hits on these negative lessons as well. And then Moses, here in our passage, hits home with a really powerful negative. Verses 9 and verse 12, he says to the people of Israel, as you go into the land, there are others there. The Canaanites are already there. I've already told you, they're appalling, they're an abomination. As you go into their land, verse 9, do not learn to imitate the detestable ways of the nations there and their abominable practices. Verse 12, anyone who does these things is detestable, is an abomination to the Lord. So what we're going to do now as we read through this, we're going to find that Moses is going to lay out in detail some of the things he's concerned about. Now, back in chapter 12 and verse 31, Moses there cites this religious practice that what Moses does in his words, that one, epitomizes all that's wrong with this Canaanite, nation. He gives like the worst thing they do, so appalling, it's like beyond imagination. What he says is that these Canaanites, and this is 1231, they even burn their sons and daughters in the fire as sacrifices to their gods. And this is something Moses says there should never be practiced in Israel. Never be practiced in Israel. So that's back in chapter 12, verse 31. So it's definitely a practice that went on. It's definitely something to steer away from them. But in our passage here, I don't think that that's what Moses is talking about. I don't think that's actually what he's describing here. Now, in your Bibles, I know it's a struggle. We're in the NIV and in the ESV. They both translate it that way. But if you check down in the footnotes, if you've got a study Bible, generally in your NIVs and your ESVs, it admits that the original actually says something slightly different. So the King James Version and the New King James Version is more literal and more accurate. What it says there, and in Dawn's Version, which I don't know what that was, anyway, but in Dawn's Version as well, which is neither NIV or ESV or King James or anything, anyway, but it says, there shall not be found among you anyone who makes his son or daughter pass through the fire. So chapter 12 was talking about killing children as ritual sacrifices. But here, Moses is talking about some other appalling practice that does involve children. But in this ritual, in our practice, the children pass through. They come out alive. So there's a similar phrase is used in Leviticus 18, 21. But in there, again, you hear this one about making the children pass through the fire, or the seed pass through the fire. But in that chapter, it's in this middle of a list of banned sexual practices. So it seems as though our translation would be out of context, but it seems as though it's not actually referring to child sacrifice. Neither of the context indicates that. Now, thankfully, we've got no idea of what that ritual involves. I've written a lot of commentaries. It's been a big distraction trying to find out what's going on here. We've got no idea what's involved. And to be honest, I don't think on a Sunday morning any of you wanted to hear that anyway. You don't need to know it. Because what we can do is we look at our passage, is we can see what the purpose of this ritual was. If you look in the context there, in verses 10 and 11, you see there's a list of things here that are described as being abhorrent abominations, terrible things to do. And this list includes divination, interpreting omens, witchcraft, wizardry, sorcery, casting or conjuring spells, mediums, spiritists, or consulting or calling up the dead. Now these are our best English translations of that passage, but if you spend time, as the commentators have, looking at the words that have been used, it captures a really distinct theme in the Hebrew. Basically, what the Canaanites were doing is they were using a whole variety of occult practices to try and understand the present and to try and foretell and try and influence the future. Now, we may think, oh, that's then, that's in the past, but these practices are still going on today. Now, some of them, like Ouija boards and tarot cards, you know, only a few people get involved with those, but they're still in regular use and they're sold in the main bookshops. And that's exactly the purpose that people are using those for. But also horoscopes in the daily newspaper. Most of you know to avoid those, like the plague. But again, that's another one. People are using, that's using the stars to try and guide people in their daily lives. They're using these occult practices to try and help them understand what's going on, to interpret the days. And the problem with these practices, we're told in verse 14, the problem with these practices is that people listen. They hearken to these things. When they go to the enchanters and the soothsayers and the horoscope writers, what they do is actually taking these things on board, and they're actually allowing their lives to be guided and influenced by occultists and evil spirits. That's what it's about. And verse 14 goes on to say, God says, the Lord your God has not permitted you to do this. He's not permitted you to do this. Now, the trouble is that people need to understand what's going on. They want to feel as though they're in control. Now, you could argue, it's just our simple nature, it's nosiness, or it's ambition, or it's pride that wants you to be in control. But it's actually much more primal, it's much more fundamental, much more basic than that. Because in understanding what's going on, people can learn to find peace. And they can have hope, because maybe they can then see an end, or they can see a way out of it and a way of escape. And this feeling of control, well, the thing is that powerlessness brings despair, makes people give up. And a lack of control, those are, you know, in stressful jobs, know that a lack of control brings stress. And stress can be a killer. It will affect and degrade you physically. And so in some ways, people do need to know what's going on. And they do need to know they've got some measure of control. And so we ask the question, well, why has God abandoned this practice? Because it appears as though it's working in some people's lives. So why has he banned it? He's banned it because he's got a far better way for people to live their lives than to put themselves under the influence of malign, dangerous, deceptive forces. That's why it's banned. And God says his solution, his way, verse 15, God will raise up for you a prophet like me from among your own brothers. You must listen to him. If you really want to understand what's going on, listen to what God has to say. Listen to the one who actually does know everything. If you want to feel as though things are in control, look to God. Put your trust in the one who created all things, sustains all things, the one who controls the future. The problem, as Moses rightly points out in verse 16 of our passage, is that people just don't want to listen to God. Not even his own people. People just don't want to listen. What Moses does, it reminds them of their shameful request at Horeb, at the base of Sinai. This is back in Exodus 20. What we find, and if you look back to that passage, God was coming amongst them and going to live amongst them, amongst his people. His presence was going to actually be there, even in the wilderness, within the tabernacle, in that Holy of Holies there, and it's going to be with them in the Promised Land. But the trouble is that when the Israelites saw God's holiness, and when they saw God's glory, they realized their own weakness and their own sinfulness, and they were afraid that by coming to God's presence, they were going to be utterly destroyed. And so they refused to listen to God directly. He was willing to talk, but they refused to listen to God directly. And they asked Moses to become an intercessor for them. They asked Moses to become a prophet who would speak to God and communicate to them what God had to say. But the trouble here, on the boundary and on the border of the Promised Land, it worked well so far. The trouble is that Moses was not allowed to go into the Promised Land. And so here in our passage, what Moses does for the Israelites, he offers them hope. God will send other prophets, other intercessors like him. The Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from among your own brothers. You must listen to him. He will put my words in his mouth and he will tell them everything I command him. Israel, in their relationship with God, chose a compromise. God agreeing to this compromise doesn't mean that it's lax. Effectively, God's saying here, you chose intermediaries. I'll allow intermediaries, but you've got to listen to them. If anyone does not listen to my words, verse 19, if anyone does not listen to my words that the prophet speaks in my name, I myself will call him to account. If this is what you've chosen, you have to abide by this. But God doesn't want his people to be naive either. There will be false prophets, and so God's people have to be discerning. In verse 20, if anything goes against the word of God, or if they advocate other gods, then reject everything the false prophet says. Not just a particular prophecy, not just that little bit of what they've said. Reject everything. Kill the person. Acts 23:23 translates it slightly differently when he quotes it here. He says, cut them off from among his people. You've just got to put them out of your presence. Don't let it be those false prophets be any part of your life. And if you want to know how to test the prophet, Moses says, in verses 21 and 22, ask yourself a simple question. Does what he tell you come true? Now, that's not the end of it, because Moses is not trying to be exhaustive here. Effectively, what Moses is doing, he says, just use your common sense. Because Moses knows, he knows all the arguments, he knows that there are sorcerers and magicians who are perfectly capable of working miracles. If you remember, he was there, Exodus 7, he was there when Pharaoh's magicians turned their staffs into snakes. He was there when their magicians turned the River Nile into blood. He was there when their magicians called up a plague of frogs up onto the land. These are pretty amazing and stunning works of these false teachers, these false prophets, these magicians and necromancers and wizards could do. But Moses also knew from experience that their power was limited. There's only so much they could do. In Exodus 8, 18 and 19, this is what we're told. But when the magicians tried to produce gnats, the next plague, they tried to produce gnats by their secret arts, they could not. And the magicians said to Pharaoh, "This is the finger of God. This is God's fingerprints. This is God at work." They're recognizing the knowledge there is something and there's a power far beyond anything that they could conjure up. And this warning that Moses gives, use your common sense and just think about it, think about your scriptures, think about what these people are saying. We would do well to take note of Moses' experience. We are in the last days, and we're warned that in the last days, many deceivers will come. And in fact, we're told at the end of all things, Revelation 19 and verse 20, that the beast was captured, and with him the false prophet who had performed the miraculous signs in his behalf. And with these signs, he had deluded those who had received the mark of the beast and worshipped his image. In the last days, there will be some astounding miracles. But if it goes against anything that God said and doesn't fit in with all your teaching and your knowledge of God, and if what happens doesn't come to pass, don't be frightened of it. Don't listen to them. Put them right out. Throw them off your bookshelves. Throw them out of your houses. Unmark the channel on your TV or your radio set. Don't listen to them. And it's interesting that this is one of the things the Jews actually took on board. If someone claimed to be speaking from God, then the Jewish people demanded a sign. They knew from it. They weren't going to listen to anybody unless they had miraculous signs. And what they demanded was not just ordinary tricks, not just ambiguous proofs, but they wanted concrete miracles that no one other than heaven, they describe it, no one other than God could perform. And so what you see is when Jesus arrives, claiming to be from God, in Matthew, in Mark, Matthew 12, Mark 8, Luke 11, John 4, lots of other places as well, every gospel recounts how the Jews demanded miraculous signs from heaven before they would accept Jesus as the spokesperson of God. And of course, Jesus performed those miraculous signs from heaven. In John 3 and verse 2, Nicodemus acknowledges that the Jewish leaders actually recognize this. This is what Nicodemus says. He came to Jesus at night and he said, "Rabbi, we know that you are a teacher who has come from God, for no one could perform the miraculous signs you were doing if God were not with him." Jesus was performing miracles way beyond the scope of any sorcerer. John 9 is a good example. Jesus heals a man who's been blind from birth. So what's wrong with this person blind from birth? We're not sure. But either his eyes or his brain or the nerves that link them had just not developed properly. He would never be able to see unless someone, God, could undertake a work of creation and complete this process that was unfinished in the womb or in his life beyond it. It was impossible. But God, the author of life and the creator, finished that work and made the man who was blind from birth see. But the Pharisees still refused to accept Jesus. Why? Because Jesus was performing this healing on a Sabbath day. What it did was it showed that Jesus refused to prescribe to their perverse and overzealous interpretation of the Sabbath laws. In John 9, 16 and 17, some of the Pharisees said, "This man is not from God, for he doesn't keep the Sabbath." But others asked, "How can a sinner do such miraculous signs? And so they were divided. Finally, they turned to the blind man. What have you to say about him? It was your eyes he opened. And the man replied, he's a prophet. The blind man was right. But Jesus was not just a prophet. He was the prophet that Moses spoke of in our passage. Peter preached about this in Acts 3, specifically in verse 22. You can see our passage quoted there. And what he was doing, he was exhorting the people of Israel, quoting our passage. This is what Peter says. Listen to everything he tells you. Anyone who does not listen to him will be completely cut off from his people. Jesus was not just a prophet, not just a spokesperson for God, but God himself, who had opened up the way for us to communicate directly with God. This relationship that God invited the Israelites to at Horeb, and they refused and rejected, is now reinstated. And God specifically says that on the Mount of Transfiguration, when we see Jesus with just a foretaste of his glory, and he shone with the brilliance of the sun. Luke 9:35. A voice came from the cloud. God said, "This is my son, whom I have chosen. Listen to him."